Today is Wednesday, February 5th, 2020. We are here at the National Park Service offices for the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve in Nome, Alaska. I'm Leslie McCartney, and we have the pleasure of having Howard Farley here with us today, and Katie. And if you'd like to introduce yourself, Katie, and then Howard, and then we can begin.
Sure. Hi, I'm Katie Cullen. I'm the Interpretation and Education Program Manager at Bering Land Bridge National Preserve in Nome, Alaska.
And Howard?
And I'm Howard Farley. I've been a part of this community since 1959.
So how did you arrive here then? Where are you from originally?
I actually have been here several times. I was born in Detroit, Michigan, and my family moved west right after World War II. And I was just a young teenager, didn't know exactly where I was going to go. And I lost my father early on, and we moved around quite a bit. And my mother worked for the FAA in the early days. And so we moved from station to station, just like other government workers. And we ended up in Seattle, Washington, as a teenager. And my mother worked for one of the airlines. And she quit her job to take another job, and she got a ride on the airplane. Mm-hmm. So she says, well, let's go to Alaska. So my sister and I and my mother, we made it to Juneau, Alaska. And that was in 1949. And I loved it. Oh, it was fantastic. We went up on a day and came back that same day.
How old were you then, Howard?
Let's see, in 49, I would have been, 12, 13, 14, right around that age.
Yeah.
And I loved it. And I thought, I'll never get back here again. You know, I mean, it's impossible. And it was one of those days. I don't know how many of you have been in and out of Juneau. It was a day when the sunshine was like it was gorgeous. And boy, it gave me a false thing, you know. So anyway, time moved on. I joined the Coast Guard in 1950. I spent part of my time in Los Angeles and on weather ships. And I took a weather ship. We took a ship that had a regular weather patrol in those days. And we made it to the Bering Sea, and that was in 1952. And then I transferred to two other ships, and there's irony coming. In 1953, I decided to leave the Coast Guard, get discharged. We were anchored off of Nome, Alaska. I was a bosun mate, and I was running boats, and I brought the Liberty Parties in. It happened to be the 4th of July, and the schedule was they would have a parade on the streets of Nome, and we've done that ever since. So all of us got together, and we got our uniforms on, our dress blues, and we're all got our rifles, and we're all ready. We get down here, we brought the boat in, and we must have got mixed up in what the time was. We got there, the parade was already over.
Oh no.
So, you know, it was kind of disappointing, you know. And so anyway, I went south. And as I traveled south, I kept running into bad deals. When I left Nome, I got on a flying boxcar with some Air Force guys. And I'm in my dress blues. And I seen the captain wink to the guy that pushes you out of the plane. I seen him wink, and I knew what they were going to do. So what they did is they said, you got to wear a parachute. They put a parachute on. I never had a parachute on in my life. They says, now when that light goes green, you got to jump out. And they thought they had me, you know. And I played along with them. Anyway, we got to Fairbanks, and I was wandering around Fairbanks, the only guy in Navy uniform. Mount Spur blew. A volcano right outside of Anchorage.
Right.
And it covered Anchorage with this much. Oh, and it was horrible.
Gosh.
I got stuck in Fairbanks for 10 days.
What year was that then?
This was 53.
Wow.
Yeah. And you know what they did to clean the fields?
Hmm.
They took a jet engine, mounted it on a truck, and used that to blow the dust off the runway so that the planes could take off.
Wow.
Yeah. So as I moved, I progressed to Anchorage. Then I got to Anchorage, and another catastrophe. That year before, a plane had gone down in Anchorage. A Globemaster was called, an Air Force plane, went down with all hands. And they just found it here a few years ago.
Mm-hmm. Oh, my.
And were able to recover it off the glacier, crashed into a glacier. Mm-hmm. So Alaska was kind of weird for me for a while. So I got down to Seattle and got discharged from the, and I decided to go to college. So I went back, finished high school, went to Washington State, got my degree. And while I was working my way through college, I also had a family.
And what did you get your degree in, Howard?
Business administration. Oh. It's an agriculture business administration.
Right.
And hit perfect for what I was going to
do. That on top of having your family at the same time.
Yeah. So I had three or four of my first family at the same time. And as to work my way through college, and this is something I think young children have got to learn today, you can work your way through college. I had the GI Bill, but it wasn't enough.
Mm.
So I actually became a journeyman butcher.
Mm.
I worked for the college veterinarians. The veterinarians usually took care of the butcher work.
Oh.
And I happened to be there, and somebody said, how would you like to work in the butcher shop? I said, oh, fine.
Hmm.
And I was college butcher shop. I said, sure. So then pretty soon I got pretty good at it, and they wanted me downtown. So then I worked in a regular professional meat market. That's when we said, yes, ma'am,
right.
What would you like to have?
Indeed.
Would you like to have five slices of salami? And how thick would you like it?
Mm-hmm.
And you looked at each person. Those are the good old days for meat people. Well, anyway, small world. One day a traveling salesman came in, and he says, you know, Northern Commercial Company in Alaska is looking for a butcher. And I said to my wife, I says, this might be a real opportunity. They were going to fly me up and give me housing and 20% discount on my groceries. And they're going to pay me too. So I came up. I lasted about 2 years there. And then I went.
Where in Alaska was that?
Right here
in Nome. Right here in Nome.
Right here in Nome.
Wow.
See, I came back.
Yeah.
Complete circle back to Nome. Irony. There's irony in everything. And I'm not done with it yet either. I went out. And I was out. And then one of the other shops in town called me and said, offered me double the money to come back. So I came back. And I've been here ever since. And I actually ran all the meat markets in town at one time.
How many were there at one time?
There was
time?
three at one time.
Mm-hmm.
I worked at each one of them.
Yeah.
And the tourist business came to me the same way. I had a dog team, and that was there was irony to that too. I was working for the U.S. Mercantile, which was a store down the street here, and one of our fellows that was their driver. We delivered groceries, just like they do today. They thought that was something new. No, we deliver groceries. Yeah. And anyway, he says, how'd you like to go for a dog team ride? He says, it's going to be a nice night tonight. We went out on a beautiful moonlit night, and I was hooked. And after that, the manager at the store says, you know, he says, I think we ought to deliver groceries for a dog team. So we did.
Wow.
Remember, I don't have a dog team yet. I'm still,
yeah.
I love it, and I'm somebody else's dog team. So anyway, this went on for a while. Then Alaska Airlines came along and said, you know, we're kind of looking for somebody to have a dog team. Well, I knew I had part interest in one because I provided all the scraps and everything for him, see. So one day he comes to me real solemn face, and he says, Howard, I've got to leave town. And he says, I'm going to have to get rid of the dogs. And I said, I said, how much? And he says, would $200 be too much? Dog sled, dogs, harness.
Everything.
I couldn't get down to the bank quick enough. And there it was. It So every lunchtime I would go out, and we had them on wheels for a while in the summertime, and we kind of had a little bit of irony there. I'm going down the road one day, and not easy to stop on a road with wheels, and I hit a guy's brand new car that he just got off the boat, off the barge. And the higher ups in the company said that, you know, insurance wise, we think you're going to have to go to a demonstration and not be able to give people rides. Because I would hook up 12, 15 dogs. We go down the road at 20 miles an hour. There was no brakes on it. You know, there's no brakes on it to stop it. So I said, that'd be fine. And then we went to just the demonstration. So when the Iditarod came along, I was more or less in the business. And it was a natural. It was a natural to go.
Yeah.
And that's the way a lot of people treated the first one. You know, see how this leads?
It does. Describe what Nome was like when you first arrived.
When I first arrived here, we had 10 bars. Now we have a few. But that's where everything was. Remember, we had no television. Only radio we had was Armed Forces radio, which wasn't that great. They never were good at it. And we didn't have TV or cell phones. We were still winding phones up. And we still had party lines. And where all the entertainment took place was downtown in the bars. If you wanted to charter an airplane, you went down to the bar where the pilots hung out. Somebody said to me the other day, "Well, are they a bunch of drunks?" No, no. That's where the public was. That's where their people were. Mm-hmm. You went down there and you said, "Well, yeah, I worked a lot with the pilots around here hauling reindeer from the reindeer herds to town here to sell it. I was one of the biggest sellers of reindeer in the history of Nome. Right here."
So you'd butchered up and then
butchered
you'd sell
up, yeah, 100,000 pounds a year. Great food, fantastic food, lean, and great for people that are on diets, and it was just fabulous food. And that's another story that comes out of Nome here.
Mm-hmm.
And so the bars had a lot to do with it, and then of course the Nome Nugget was, and there was a story going about the Nome Nugget that if you wanted to start a story, they would start a story in the Nome Nugget, and it would go make all the bars and come back to the Nome Nugget. It wouldn't be the same story. So there was a gossip. And what do we got for gossip now? We got these phones. You see?
Yeah.
Okay. One of the ladies that worked for AC as a cashier, she got a better job. She was the operator for the local telephone company. And they got rid of the wind-ups. But you'd pick up the phone and you'd give her a number, it'd be red 35 or black 98 or something like that. I can never remember the stupid number, so anyway, I would, and her name was Fern. One of her sons now runs the bar there. The one right across the street. Breakers. And her name was Fern. And I'd call, "Fern, I want so-and-so." "This is not allowed. Come on, Fern." She says, "Okay, I'll only do this one time." And she knew where everybody was because she was the operator. See, she knew where everybody was. And we know what operators, they love to get in the middle of things like that, you know. So anyway, we went towards the dial telephones.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, dial telephones was started by this Telalaska here.
Hmm.
And that was run by a local company.
Hmm.
And he was Charlie Reeder's brother, Pete. He owned a telephone company. So anyway, there was an old gentleman that hung out downtown. His name was Charlie Jones. And he was old. Well, of course, I was young. He was old and kind of hard of hearing. And I was sitting there at the bar time having a drink. And Charlie says to Pete, he says, "Well, when are you going to bring me that newfangled phone up?" He says, "Well," he says, "Charlie, I'll see if I can get up there this afternoon." So he gets up there and he installs the phone. comes back down to the bar, and Charlie goes home the next day, comes down to the bar, and he says, I thought you put that phone in my house. He says, I could have swore I did, but he says, I'll go up and check on it. He went up to Charlie's house. Charlie was a little, couldn't see very good either, and he forgot to turn it around. Oh. Charlie took one look at it. He didn't see the dial. And that joke went up and down. And it went around and around and around. And they had a club here in town called the Artie Club in those days. And they had raffles. Oh, they were famous for raffles. They raffled off a Piper.
Airplane?
Oh, wow.
Yes, I'm telling you, a Piper airplane. I mean, that takes a lot of raffle money. And that was the grand prize. And a pilot won it.
Jeez.
Yeah, wow. Yeah. So this town, if you wanted money, pull tabs came later.
Yeah.
But in the early days, 4, 5, 6 games were going on at every single bar. And gambling, there was a game that went on at the used to be the other side of there. Oh, God, what's the name of it? It'll come to me. But anyway, there was a game there that went on for 30 years.
Good.
A gambling game that went on. People sat in there, and the whole Alaska was wide open for gambling. And this is before statehood and shortly thereafter. Remember, the state didn't get organized right after.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they fumbled around a lot. And in the meat markets, it was real funny. I talked to the first weight guy that came through for the state. He says, you won't believe what people have been weighing meat on. Baby scales and, and these produce scales. And he'd look at the scale and he says, that scale's off 10%. The guy'd look at him, oh, no kidding? And the same thing with gasoline. They inspect the gasoline pumps and they were all screwed up. So statehood didn't come gracefully. It came by starts and stutters, you know. And I got right there. I remember Alaska became a state in January of 59. I arrived here in November of 59. Now, let me tell you about my arrival the first time. I had a suit on in those days. Men wore suits. I didn't wear a hat, but I wore a suit. And all I owned was a summer suit because I didn't come from the polar regions. I got to Fairbanks on Pan American Airways. It was 78 degrees below zero. There was one taxi running, and he only could get about this much defrost on us. And he kept the car running for 24 hours. So I went to the hotel. Next morning I got up, got on the plane. It was still 78 below. And how they ever flew that airplane, I don't, to this day, I don't know. And DC-3. And on the way to Nome, we went through COTS. And in COTS, it was 45 below.
Warmed up.
Further south.
Yeah.
And then we got to Nome, it was 30 below. So I went to the Whaley House. It's a house up here. It's a familiar house in town. AC owned that at that time. Northern Commercial Company, which is AC, now owned that house. And that's where I stayed upstairs. And it was a two-family house. And the first night, I hadn't bought the family up yet. The first night, the house on the corner burned. I woke up about 2 o'clock in the morning. All I can see is this flames.
Oh, my goodness.
I mean, you don't fight a fire at 30 below zero very good, you know. Mm. And it just went up. It just went over in the corner from where I live. And, oh, my gosh. And that was my beginning in Nome.
What was your first impressions of Nome after the house fire? What?
I thought, oh, my God, what am I getting myself into? I always had self-doubts. In those days, we didn't own cars. We walked everywhere because, remember, the town didn't have Bering View or any of these other places. It was all compact. The roads were, there were no roads. At that time, there was two guys that worked for the city. One ran a bulldozer, that was Harry, and the other one was, he ran the grader. And that's all we had. Two guys took care of the roads. The roads were closed. They didn't go anywhere. They went to the airport, and that was it. And the airport was different in those days, too. When I got here in November, and in December, the planes were stalled because of the weather, getting the Christmas stuff in. So one time, the word went out to the bars, we need help. So we all went out there with our pickup trucks and company trucks, and we helped haul mail from an airplane out on the tarmac. We helped load it, and we took it to the bus. I mean, people did this.
Yeah.
And it was something, I'll tell you. I'd never been in a place like that. And of course, that at that time the gold company was still operating, and gold was the master in this town. In the summertime they opened it up, and there was hundreds of jobs, and the King Islanders came, mm-hmm. in their skin boats, and the Diameters came in their skin boats, and they came to work. And they parked it right down here, the other side of the hotel, right down there, and put their tents up, and the guys went to work in the thaw fields in order to provide work for the dredge.
Yeah.
They thawed the ground out with cold water ahead of the dredge.
Uh-huh.
And this is where a lot of the young guys in this town, and older guys, got their first jobs,
hmm.
in the thaw fields, they called it.
So when did your family come up?
They came up within the next month before Christmas.
What was your wife's first impressions?
Not very good. not very good at all. Because we'd been there twice. And one day, I might as well tell you the whole story. One day she says, I've had enough. So she took me to court and divorced me and took the kids.
Oh.
Yeah. But that's not the end of the story.
Keep going.
While I was working down at the U.S. Merck, when I was going through this tumultuous thing, and I won't mention names or anything.
Nope.
But anyway, I'm going through this bad deal, and I met a young lady, and that young lady has now been married to me for 52 years.
Wow, that's lovely. And how many children do you
have? We have five children.
Lovely.
She had one child, and I had four, so we have 10.
10.
And Mimi is one of a set of twins.
Oh, my.
Yes.
Lovely.
I have six girls and four boys.
So it worked out nice.
It did work out beautiful.
Yeah.
And
she's from here?
Yes. She's from King Island.
Right. Yeah. Very, very nice. Yeah. So a happy ending story.
Yeah, and it's not over yet.
No. 50, you said 55 years?
Well, let's see. We had our 50th anniversary, and we were married in 1967.
Mm.
And you know how I remember it? It's right on the wall, and one of the lady friends embroidered it.
Oh,
and
nice.
And there it sits.
Very nice.
And I can't miss it. But I didn't miss one.
Oh.
took a long time to get over that.
Yeah.
But anyway, that's...
But you've been in a lot of businesses.
Oh, yeah.
So you started off doing butcher work?
I've ran the meat business in several places, and also used to have a locker club here.
Oh.
Rented out locker space.
Oh.
I managed that for a while. And right along, we've been commercial fishermen. I pioneered commercial fishing in this area, too.
How long were you a commercial fisherman?
I'm still a commercial
fisherman. Are you really?
Oh, yeah. I'm still a commercial fisherman. We got three boats. And we got three boats, Bristol Bay boats and Lumen. And we're in the fishing business. We fish for crab, halibut, cod.
So tell me, so how long have you been doing that then?
I started that in 1962.
So from 1962 to now, there must have been big changes in the commercial fishing industry.
Oh, yes, yes.
Can you tell me about that?
Okay, what happened now? When the state took over fishing from the feds, the feds knew that it was coming because, you know, it had been broadcast. And the federal management of fisheries has been off and on. They were the managers because, you know, of course, we were in the state. And some of the old-time practices, traps and things like that, just weren't allowed. When it became a state, we changed some things drastically. And another thing too, when we became a state, some of the fisheries were in very bad shape. Mm. And what do you do when they're in bad shape? You stop for a while. And we did.
They were in bad shape because the stocks were low?
They were in bad shape. They've been overfished.
Oh, that's, yeah. Overfish is what I meant, yeah.
Overfishing is the big problem, just about in every fishery. They're doing the same thing now with the crab.
Oh.
And that's serious business.
Right.
What they're doing is they're fishing on a declining population. Mm-hmm. Down in Bristol Bay, in 1979 or 76, they harvested 230 million pounds of king crab in Bristol Bay. Now it's down to 6 million.
Mm-hmm.
So it's been declining.
Yeah.
And another thing we don't know what effect the Russians are having. Remember, we share those grounds out there with the Russians. There's a boundary.
Mm-hmm.
And we don't know what they're doing, because
right.
they don't volunteer to tell us.
So when the state became, when the fisheries was taken over from the feds to the state, you were saying there was a lot of changes. What other changes?
Well, another thing too, we finally started enforcing the high sea pirates that were harvesting salmon on the high seas.
Mm-hmm.
And we got that through Congress. That went through Congress, actually, to set that up. The North Pacific Management Council was set up.
So where did you fish? Did you go up all around the Seward Peninsula?
I fished basically in Nome.
Uh-huh.
And here's how it worked. I fished in Nome. We caught too many fish. Fish and Game cut us off. We went down to safety. We fished down there. We caught too much fish. They cut us off. I went to Golovin, took the whole family to Golovin. We fished for several years down there. And then finally by then things started to come back.
Mm-hmm.
But you want to remember, a lot of these streams were gold mining streams.
Mm.
And gold and fish don't get along.
Right.
Because what happens is they mine the very place where fish tend to
spawn. Yeah.
And a lot of the rivers were basically fished out and they're just starting. Some of them are just starting to come back now, because it takes a long time for rivers to heal.
Yeah.
And
same as for overcatching. I mean, then, you know, you have large fish, and then they start smaller and smaller and smaller until it's not worth catching.
Are they
coming back in
size? They're coming back. And another thing, too, Fish and Game has had its ups and downs also. when the way they were counting fish is a clicker and flying an airplane. Now, you can't tell the variety of a fish. You can by size, but you don't know whether that's a silver or a chum or a king or what. It's just click, 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 and sometimes you can't click fast enough.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the means. It was a good one. It was a good thing. But now we actually have places the fish flies, goes through, and it's counted.
Oh.
Now that is more accurate. Right. Now we get to see the species, which fish. And before, we thought we were just a thing that had three or four fish. Kings, chums, pinks, silvers. But now we're finding out reds are going up some of these streams.
Mm.
And we didn't know that, because another thing too, that came from state. We found out that you can fertilize a lake, Salmon Lake. They fertilized it, and the fish came back.
Right.
It's a marvelous invention.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, interesting.
Yeah, it is. And so what's happening, the reds are coming back to Salmon Lake, and guess who they got to come by to get there? They got to come by the rest of us that are fishing for chums and other fish.
So over the years, did you change how you fished for what species of fish you were fishing for?
Now, chum has always been the big fish, and misnamed. Dogfish.
Oh.
Yeah, dogfish.
Mm-hmm.
Fit only for sled dogs.
Mm.
Bad reputation. The chum salmon is a beautiful fish. all fish are beautiful fish from my standpoint. Mm-hmm. There's no fish. Look at what they're actually eating in the world now. Bait fish, mm-hmm. what we would call bait fish. All fish are being utilized. So that's good because that doesn't concentrate. But anyway, we've seen the fish go from nothing to something. Mm-hmm. And we've also seen the price go from nothing to something. And I used to sell, in fact, for several years, I had my own markets in Anchorage.
Hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's where you... So where do you sell your fish now?
To Norton Sound Economic.
Right.
They're the buyer. Hub. They're the buyer now.
Right.
But I had my own markets.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I pioneered a lot of the market. We had places in Anchorage that wanted fish.
Yeah.
And Cook Inlet was also down. Bristol Bay almost went broke for a number of years. I mean, they were in horrible shape. And they were having... I fished Bristol Bay one summer, 1980. Mm. I never worked so hard for so little in my life. But I came back for enough to pay off the mortgage on my house. Mm. And
what about the herring fishery? It doesn't come up this far, does it?
It did.
It
did. And we fished it. But the problem with that is that the Japanese, they want a certain size roll, 300 grams, that fits into these little wooden boxes, and it's all the same. And this is a traditional thing. And it's salted, cured. Our herring here get too big.
Oh.
They won't fit the fishery.
Oh, my.
And remember, you're seining them or gillnetting at them.
Yes.
Okay, we started off with 2.5-inch mesh, fishing them with... And I was also in the net making business, hanging business. I did that for years. In fact, I still do it.
Oh.
I hang nets.
Yes.
Build nets. And I started with 2.5-inch mesh, and it got up to 3-inch mesh. I mean, that's a half inch,
mm-hmm.
and that means it's a bigger fish.
Right.
And the market, they just aren't interested. The fish are there. They figure there's 50,000 metric tons in Norton Sound.
So over the years, I mean, that's sort of like not a taste has changed, but has people's taste changed? So was one fish more popular at one time to sell?
Oh, the king salmon by
far.
Yeah, and the problem is the attitude of a lot of the villages is that, well, my God, this fish has been here forever. My great-great-great-great-great-grandparents fished king salmon. We want to fish them too. Well, what they've tended to do, they've tended to fish them out. Mm-hmm. And the way they've done it, well, with fish wheels for one thing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that catches everything.
Yeah.
But the mesh that they've been fishing with, up to 8-inch mesh.
Wow.
And that means they're taking the big females. The big females are the fishery.
Mm-hmm.
They get in the Yukon. That's the one that's going to go all the way up to Canada and spawn.
Yeah.
And they're going to spawn in all the streams along the way. And if you catch those big ladies, you've got problems because what happens. So what they've done, and it took years to do it, because I was in the selling business. I worked for Lummi, one of the fish big outfits that sells fishing gear. I was their agent for here. And they lowered it to the 7.5, and that will save the king salmon, because that'll mean that the big ones will bounce off, the little ones will go through, and the 7.5 will catch just the right ones.
Right. Oh my.
Yeah, because the big ones are they might be a 5 or 6 year old fish, and the ones that are too small might be spawning. They don't all spawn in the same year. The jacks, what's called jacks, mm-hmm. kings, and that's a salmon that doesn't spawn, and that's great to catch.
Mm-hmm.
They're lean, and they taste just like king salmon, but they're not going to spawn, so you're not hurting anything. So we've been all through all these species.
Yeah,
I was on the advisory board from this area for years.
On the advisory board for the
fishing game.
Yeah,
on both.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. For years.
So did you, so that was on the fish side, did you do the game side too?
Yeah.
So can you talk about that?
When we first came here, of course, there was no moose.
Mm-hmm.
The moose, that's another story, came later. The big story was reindeer. reindeer. There was up to 25,000 reindeer on this peninsula. Reindeer was the prime food of just about everybody. I bring in beef, frozen beef, but reindeer was something that we had, and it was really strange when I first worked over here at AC. The butcher had it hidden underneath the counter, in the freezing, frozen counter.
Had the beef hidden or the reindeer?
No, the reindeer.
Oh.
And you come up and you want, most everybody want a reindeer stew. And then you'd reach under there and you had a pot full of frozen reindeer already cut up and stew, and you put it in a bag, in a paper bag, and that's how it was handled. And then they would pay you cash at the butcher shop. Silver dollars were prominent in those days. There's nothing dirtier in this world than a silver dollar that's been in everybody's hands. And I mean, it just, I mean, I'm a butcher, I'm sanitary, I know what it is, you know. And you'd see some guy digging in his pockets, and I thought, oh my God. So I put my foot down and I said, we can't do this anymore. I said, you'll have to, we'll properly wrap the meat up and tape it like it's supposed to, and you'll take care of it up front at the cash register. And they had the old wind-up cash register.
Oh, wow.
and some of the girls were...
taking it down. Yeah.
God. And then finally we got the electric ones. And a couple of gals quit because they weren't quick enough to do it. So this is what we had. And it was primitive, I'm telling you.
So what happened when the moose started arriving?
Okay, here. The way we found out about it, it was just kind of word of mouth. We had a commander of the scout battalion, the commander. And he was out on maneuvers back near the park, where the park is now, back in there. They used to have maneuvers back in there. And shot a moose. And it made the Gnome Nugget.
Hmm.
Well, it was a big one, too. Well, what happened is that they had some bad fires in Fairbanks. And they felt that the moose moved over here just slowly. We didn't even know it. They just moved slowly in here as the reindeer started to decrease. Mm. Reindeer and moose don't eat the same thing.
So what's the difference? What do
moose eat? Twigs.
Twigs.
Bark feeders.
Caribou or lichen?
Lichens. Two different animals. And so they can intermingle without too much trouble. And you want to remember, over the years, I dealt with the reindeer herders privately. Buy it for the stores. So anyway, what happened with the reindeer? They had herders that were actually out there herding. They couldn't get it. No, they came from Siberia. Now the Siberian Eskimos over there, they herd by herding on foot or with animals, and they've done that, and that's why they're successful. The guys over here were basically hunters. They weren't herders. The herding was actually invented over here when they bought the reindeer from over there to here. And then it became an industry.
Mm-hmm.
But what happened is that as it became an industry, it started producing money, you know. And a lot of the herders were buying snowmobiles, and they were buying this and they were buying that. And they weren't herding. And the problem is, if you don't herd reindeer, they'll eat too much of one grazing area and not enough of the other, and then of course the bears get after them and the wolves but when they were herding, they kept the bear population down to way down, and the wolf population almost extinct because when a wolf came on your grazing line, you had the right to kill it, and they did. And if they hadn't, there wouldn't have been any reindeer.
Right.
But as the reindeer decreased and the moose population increased, that meant the bears were something to, and the reindeer herders weren't killing bears anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Larry Davis, one of the most famous herders from this area, he got into it with Fish and Game. Mm-hmm. He says, if I see a bear, I'm going to kill it because it's going to be killing my living.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, I'm not going to even butchered. He says, I'm just going to kill it. And if you don't like it, you know what you can do.
Wow.
It was his.
Yeah.
And he had the grazing rights perfectly within his rights. Mm. Now, as long as you have that, we didn't have much of a bear population. It was all kept down. And another thing, when I first came here, there was a $75 bounty on wolves. Mm. And they never went to waste. They make the most beautiful ruffs you've ever seen. Mm-hmm. And
has that population gone back up now, the wolf population?
Yes, it has, because there's nobody killing them.
Right.
And there's nobody trapping them. Trapping is starting to...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And trapping is way down. That was one of the biggest things in the village, is that the trappers would go out, you know, at the proper time and trap a certain number of animals. And unless man intercedes and keeps that balance, they'll slip right in there and mm-hmm. take over.
Yeah.
And so another thing, too, is the muskox.
Wow.
That's another subject. When I was in the Coast Guard, there's a light on the island down there, right off of the Nunavak. That's where they came from, muskox.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
There's a light up there. It's called Cape Mohican. And on a foggy day in 1953, I was in charge of lighting the lights. I was called the Wiki. And that was my job to take care of that. We walked with the force. I had about 10 guys with me. We were walking up towards Cape Mohican. And here they were, a whole bunch of these muskox. We'd never seen them. We didn't have any idea what they even were. Some guy says, yeah, I think I seen one in the zoo here, you know. We didn't know. And as we walked up, they felt threatened, and they formed a circle, mm-hmm. you know, like, and so we just, you know, so we kind of worked our way around them and got the light lit and took care of business and got out of there. But that's the first time I seen them. And then later on, the federal government transplanted mm-hmm. them to this area and to some other areas too. But here they took off because they're safe here. And every single year, Mama Bear sits up on top of Anvil and looks down at them and just licks her lips. And so the herd is growing and they've stayed here. They do wander around a little bit, but they've stayed here. Mm-hmm. And they've been a problem. They've mm-hmm. been a problem, especially the old males, the ones that are, you know, the breeders, the man, they got a chip on their shoulder all the time.
So how have they been a problem?
They stomp. They stomp dogs.
Oh.
Yeah. That's been a real problem. People that have dogs just at home, they got to protect them. Yeah.
Wow. I did not realize that.
Yes. Because they're herd animal.
Yeah.
And that's another thing, too. In the spring when they have their babies, the bears start coming in.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, the wolves are out there all the time. And so the reindeer is almost gone.
Mm.
The caribou has more or less absorbed them.
Hmm.
I haven't seen a herd in years now. They used to be able to drive down to safety, and there'd even be them on safety down there.
Ooh.
Which is almost an island.
Yeah.
And you'd see them down there.
Now, do you fish in the winter time too, or is it just mostly summertime?
No. We started a winter crab fishery.
Did you?
Yeah. And it was supposed to be just for Nome.
Yeah.
Because we had a cook pot here.
Mm.
One of the fishing companies came in and set up a cooking operation.
Oh.
And the first year we caught 25,000 pounds of king crab.
And what year would that have been? Do you remember?
Probably 70s.
Okay.
In the 70s, probably.
And that went off pretty good for you?
Yeah, it went good. But what happened is when Norton Sound Economic came in, their name is Economic, and they're promoting economics, and they started wanting a winter crab fishery.
Hmm.
And the crab fishery has expanded. And the problem with winter crabbing is that crab can only be sold if they're alive. Oh. And when you pull a crab out of the cold water and he hits that ice, he's almost dead. Mm. So you see what I mean? Now what they do is they cover their holes with insulation.
Okay.
To keep the hole from freezing.
Huh.
And they have to put the crab in the wintertime into a tote with water in it.
To keep it alive.
Salt water.
Yeah.
Yeah, to keep it alive. And that's the problem. Huh. Getting them from there to there to the place.
Right.
And then Norton Sound Economic says we only want number one crab.
And that's a certain size?
That's a certain size, and it's no legs missing or anything like that. No barnacles. Mm. Perfectly clean crab, number ones. And they got a live market for that in the Orient.
Oh.
What happens is on this international airport at Anchorage, you can deliver crab there and have them in the Orient within 24 hours.
Wow.
They put them in sawdust. Wet sawdust.
Wet sawdust. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah.
And so what if you pull up crabs that aren't number one? What happens to them?
You got to put them back.
Okay.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
They're still...
Or you can eat them. You know, you have them for personal use.
Yeah. Yeah.
And in most fisheries, we do have it where, you know, you can take whatever you want home.
So has the winter crab season been extended a bit more?
They've been extended. And the problem they had last year, the ice went out in April.
Oh,
so and it was it, what had happened is it was a low ice, a warm winter, and first time I have ever seen it, and I've been here since
forever.
And the ice formed, but it was very weak, and the wind had been blowing east, which is extraordinary. It's not a wind that you expect.
What is the predominant wind
here? The predominant wind here is north in the winter and around the, it can vary in the summer.
Yes.
Because that's when there's changes. But in the wintertime, the ice normally in the old days would form in October.
Okay.
And by November, the small boat harbor would be closed and the ice would start to form. And as it got colder and colder and colder, remember the north wind is helping it. It's actually extending the slush out, and it doesn't freeze all in one chunk. This is back and forth, and what it would do is it would freeze in October, and we'd see. I've seen ice 5 foot thick in Norton Sound.
Wow.
Yeah. In fact, let me confirm that. Let's see. This is pre-Iditarod. When I was working down at the U.S. Merck, the same guy that I bought the dog team from, he says, "Can I borrow your car? I had a Camino."
Oh, an El Camino.
And it's really not a pickup truck. It's more of a car.
You're more like
a, yeah, it's a car.
It's made fashionable now by Clint Eastwood movies, but yes. I remember El Camino.
Oh God. So anyway, I said, "Yeah, take it for the weekend." I thought he was going out and driving around on the roads. And Buffy, oh God, Buffus is their name. Well, anyway, he took his pickup out, and he was driving up and down in front of Nome on the ice. Ice was about that thick.
Wow.
So next day, I said, we brought the car back, and I said, well, how'd it go? Yeah, it went fine. He says, I drove clear up to El Dorado. I mean, that's a river. He drove by El Camino all the way up to El Dorado. That meant there wasn't any roads over there. He got out on the ice, went up to safety, went under the bridge. Well, there was no bridge in those days. It was a ferry. And he drove it around there and across the Sound and up to El Dorado.
Good heavens.
Because I had been up there with the dog team, you know, I knew what it was.
Yeah.
And he's from, he was from Cobuk area. And in fact, that's what he told me that day. He decided to go home. And anyway, God, he drove it up there. And I,
But if it had been a year like you said last
year, you wouldn't even got out of the causeway. So there is, and what happened this last year is around April, the ice was, it looked fair. It opened the season. Mm-hmm. Some of the gold miners were working,
mm-hmm.
and then all of a sudden the wind turned north, and bingo, out it went.
The wind went from the north?
Yeah, it turned north.
Wow.
It had been east.
East, yes.
Was holding it in there, see?
Right.
And 1 minute it turned north.
It was gone.
It was gone. It had raised up just a little bit and was gone. And then it slushed in and out all year. Now, in all the time I've been here, that's the first time I've ever seen that.
Yeah.
But look this year.
Mm-hmm.
You can't say it's something that's going to stay.
It's all chunk. Oh, it's
we got lots of ice.
Yeah.
And it's pretty solid.
Yeah.
Because we've had cold weather.
Right.
We've had cold weather. We've had warm weather. But we've had enough cold weather. And it's been below zero.
Mm-hmm.
I've had 20 below at my house.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this is not like last year. I think last year was an anomaly.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I'm not a great believer in global warming.
Right. Yeah,
because if you look at it technically, it's changed 1 degree.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the entire Earth, 1 degree. Mm-hmm. Now, what difference is that going to make? You know.
So are they out crabbing already then this year?
There's a few guys that are doing it to subsistence.
Oh, okay.
But they have not opened it, to my knowledge.
And when do they normally open the crab fishing in the winter?
It would have been open in January.
Oh, really?
Yeah, yeah,
okay.
It would be closing.
Interesting.
Yeah, it would be closing.
Yeah.
It wouldn't be for very long because they don't have much quota.
Yeah.
But last summer, because of the warm blob, I know about the warm blob.
Yeah, talk about the warm blob.
The warm blob, there was a research team from NOAA that was up here.
Oh.
They've been up here a number of times in the summertime, and they've been tracing this. And what's happened is that, which is normally cold, had sent a glob of warm water up.
Up the coast.
Up the coast,
mm-hmm.
into the northern Bering Sea. The southern Bering Sea has weather that varies because it's close to the Pacific and other places. But this up here had this glob come, and it spread in the Norton Sound, because Norton Sound is shallow, for mm-hmm. one thing. And last year, we didn't get crab.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I had two boats out there.
Mm-hmm.
And, I mean, we were going to the places we normally go to, and, you know, through the season. And finally,
Is it because it wasn't cold enough?
We couldn't
or
find
you couldn't could, find them?
Couldn't find them.
Huh.
And it wasn't that we didn't know how. We've been fishing these crab for 25, 30 years.
Yeah.
We had it all on GPS. Every single pot we had ever dropped is in our GPS. So we went to all the places, seasonally,
mm-hmm.
and otherwise.
And
there was no crab. Some guys got them 40 miles out. But this is a small boat fishery. We're not going 40 miles out,
mm-hmm.
you know, for crab. So what I think, and Norton Sound is shallow, and what I think is that the glob affected Norton Sound more because it's a sound,
mm-hmm.
it's not an ocean.
Mm-hmm.
Now you go out into the Bering Sea drops off
right
to canyons
yeah.
towards the Russian side, and so the cold doesn't affect the crab that hang around there, but as they come up into shallower water, it would definitely have an effect.
Mm-hmm. So when you say it's shallow, what would it be?
100 feet of water out here would be.
That's all.
That's all. In fact, if you were to take the average out there, and I've been all over
yeah.
north, almost every inch of it. And remember, the Yukon flows out,
mm-hmm.
and it brings all the sediment and,
the
and everything.
Yeah.
And if you draw a line from Nome across,
mm-hmm.
everything up from there is soft bottom. So it's good crab. But another thing, too, as you get towards Sledge Island,
mm-hmm.
it drops off,
mm.
and the current gets stronger because you're at where it goes into the Bering Sea.
Right.
And but it's basically shallow. It's a shallow
yeah.
It's a shallow basin is what it is.
Right.
It has a 12-hour a 12-hour flow of water back and forth, and water coming down out of the Yukon
mm-hmm.
Would be warm. Fresh water.
Yes.
And it revolves this way,
mm.
around the sound. This is mm. the setup.
Right.
When the fish come out of the Yukon, Mm-hmm. We get a few of them over here. Mm. We're not supposed to, but we do.
That blob, that warm blob, sort of really affected the crowd. What about any other fish? Did it?
I think it helps salmon. Okay. Really, I think it's good for salmon.
Mm.
Because salmon are not, they don't seem to be, there's not much of a temperature thing in there. In their makeup, because they go up rivers that are ice cold,
yeah,
and they go up rivers that are almost boiling. I mean, it doesn't seem to doesn't seem to matter. In fact, I think it might be advantage, because another thing too, one thing that these warm globs they form, there's food. It's good for food growth,
right?
But there's other downsides to it too. They this year, this comes from. Pacific Management Council, they will probably close down, if they haven't already, close down fishing for cod in the Gulf of Alaska.
And why would that be?
Warm water. Yeah, warm water.
So the cod really like the cold water.
They like
water.
The cold. They're bottom fish.
Right.
They're scavenger fish, actually. And they're moving here. This last year, my crew got 100 cod in their pots.
Wow, and that's a lot more than what you would normally
get. We used to get one or two, and we're talking about the big babies.
Oh, really?
Wow. We got a picture. Some of the guys use bait bags.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, big bait bags. And it shows a cod that tried to suck that bait bag out. He's hanging there by his mouth with this big bag. And I got pictures of some of my crew with cod.
So the cod are coming up because the water's colder here.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. In the Barents Sea.
Yes.
And they're coming in here. Remember, they feed.
Yep.
And the food, obviously, they might have overfished it in the Gulf. And they tended to move up here. But the trouble with cod, it's not worth anything.
No, I love cod.
I mean, it's a delicious fish.
It's delicious.
And in fact, I had cod for dinner for 3 days. And it's a great fish.
Yeah.
But they're not worth any money.
Just no market for them right now.
Well, there's a market, but they just don't get what salmon do.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, the thing with cod is, another picture that we got, cod with one of those other fish that they fish with the trawlers. It's a cod.
Mm-hmm. A ling cod?
No, not the ling cod. There's one more.
The halibuts?
No. No, they'll take a halibut too.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
The cod's got a big mouth.
Yeah.
Huge mouth.
Hmm.
Oh, five times bigger than a salmon or halibut mouth.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Wow. So that's why they can. Yeah, we find them with whole fish in them.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
With the tail sticking out.
Wow.
Pollock.
Pollock, that's it.
Cod feed on pollock.
Okay. Mm.
Yeah.
And pollock like colder water too? Or?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Pollock. So this whole. And this blob was not just 1 year. It was several years. Because we knew it.
Mm-hmm.
But we just didn't know what the climax was.
Right.
The climax, I'm saying, was this year, last year.
So the blob is starting to
thin out
now.
Thin out, yeah, I think.
Right.
Now they're going to be researching that this summer. Mm-hmm. And very intense with the trawlers. Several trawlers.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it's real funny, the company that I own,
Farley Marine,
we have the pilot boat for all the foreign ships coming.
Mm-hmm.
We also do crew changes, and we also do any other charter type work. We work for the city.
Do they ask you to keep any instruments on your boat measurements and things like that?
Yeah, anything. In fact, we do the... We do the bottom survey down at Cape Nome.
Mm-hmm.
We do that every couple of years. The people that are using it have to pay for it, and they charter us. We go down and put their equipment aboard.
Hmm.
And the same thing when they were doing port work. We did port work this last year, too, with the Corps of Engineers.
And what did that entail?
They were getting ready, we're going to expand the
port. Yes, the port's going to hopefully be larger.
It's almost there. We're getting close.
Okay.
And what they were doing is, we do all the survey work for them, too.
And what's it going to take to increase that port?
They're going to make it wider.
Mm-hmm. To take in the bigger ships?
Yeah, and wider and more places to tie them up. And then it's going to extend it out further. Into deeper water.
So it doesn't have to have a, it doesn't have to be dredged the bottom.
Some of it will have to be dredged.
Mm.
But right at the mouth is about 25 feet. And they want to get it to 40.
Oh, wow.
40 will handle just about anything. And that doesn't cut us off because pilots have to bring ships in, whether they anchor them or whether they bring them in. My company still takes care of that.
Were you here when the Project Chariot project was being discussed? Or was that after, did you arrive after that? Remember Project Chariot?
Up north where they were going to, and they did.
This is the one where they're going to blow it up.
Blow it up with a nuclear.
Yeah. You remember that?
Oh, yes.
That must have been quite the adventure.
Well, another thing, too, is you want to remember Crowley Maritime.
Mm-hmm.
Started right here in Nome.
Oh, did it?
Yeah.
I did not know that.
BNC. BNC was the original in Kotzebue. And what happened is that the government was bringing ships up here.
Mm-hmm.
In 53, when I was up here for about 2 years, from 52 to 53, and I got to see some things that, in fact, I've got a picture somewhere. In 1952, we, the U.S. government, let the Japanese back into the Bering Sea. Mm. And it was a big day. Our ship was the presenting ship. We had the admiral aboard. We had the flags up.
Wow.
And we weren't supposed to take pictures, but I did take a picture, and it showed Marus. I mean Maru. You know what a Maru is? That's a Japanese ship.
Yeah.
They're all called Maru.
Oh.
Then they have names and numbers. And I took a picture, and as far as you could see, there were these Maru fishing boats. Not fishing boats, fishing ships.
Oh.
That's when we let them back into the Bering Sea.
How did that affect the fishery industry?
It raised hell for a while. And why it did is that after the war, and even before the war, they were using gill nets.
Oh.
They were illegally fishing. And the Japanese continued that on for a long, long time. And that's why the Coast Guard was up here to do we did the lights. But the Coast Guard was also up here, and they're still up here, trying to get that taken care of.
Yeah.
Because they were fishing illegally. We could see them. When the herring season first started up here, I was out on the herring field in practically all over Norton Sound, and we'd look off in the distance, and there'd be a Maru. And you couldn't possibly miss it because they were all painted bright colors.
Hmm.
Yeah.
And there they were. But they had to stay out 12 miles. But they were coming in and taking herring. And they were taking salmon. And that's why the North Pacific Management Council was invented.
Mm.
Ted Stevens and, it'll come back to me, were instrumental in getting that going because that meant that we were protecting our fishery internationally and that we were starting to enforce the 200-mile limit.
Well, I guess it's similar today in that with the ice, receding or not coming as far, it's opening up more shipping lanes.
Yes.
And so you must be involved in all of those.
We are involved in it.
Yeah.
Now, this last year, the Northwest Passage and the East Passage, there's two passages. One that goes to the east to Murmansk. The other one goes east into Canada. It opened up early. But the year before, it didn't. The Canadian icebreakers came down and opened up the Northwest Passage. Mm-hmm. We didn't have to say a word. Nobody knew about it except a handful of us. We knew about it because every single ship that goes through the Northwest Passage over Canada has to have an ice navigator.
Oh.
They changed it. Not ice. They were using it... they have another name for it. But anyway, they're ice navigators. They're guys that know the ice. Okay. Dutch Harbor's not a good place to land an airplane. It's just a horrible place to get in and out of.
Mm.
More of our ice navigators are coming through Nome.
Oh.
And we take them out to the ships. And they go through. And then when they come back, we take them off.
Huh.
So that's another.
Right.
And I'm working with an agent. I work with agents. shipping agencies. There's a Canadian shipping agency, which has its headquarters in Texas. And
all places.
I've been dealing with them for years. I'm one of their pioneers as far as our Northwest Passage.
Yeah.
And what we do, we pick the pilot up, take him out to the ship, they go through. Then if they come back through, we take them off.
Mm-hmm.
It's better than going to Dutch Harbor, because Dutch Harbor is isolated, it's stormy, and they only have small airplanes that go in there.
Right. Bigger planes.
And it's
here.
A long way to Anchorage. So my selling point down through the years is get off and known.
Mm-hmm.
We got two jets a day.
Mm-hmm.
Big jets.
Yeah.
And we'll take you directly to Anchorage, directly to Canada, directly to...
Yep.
Yeah. So
right.
that's what we do also. And another thing, too, I work for Alaska Maritime Agency. It's the biggest shipping agency in the state.
Mm-hmm.
And I've been working with them for almost 40 years. And that goes way, way back. And how it started, there was a company called A&P, a Japanese company. And they decided to make a movie, and it's called The Alaska Story. And it's about the first Japanese that came to Alaska and their trials and tribulations. And I was involved in that movie. And one of my sons is in it.
And when was that made, Howard?
Hmm?
When was that made?
I have to think back about that.
Okay.
About the year, but it was pre-Iditarod.
Okay.
Yeah, probably in the late 60s, first 70s. And,
interesting.
It was one of the biggest movies ever produced.
Wow.
Yeah, in Japan. And I met a gentleman there who was their interpreter. And that gentleman is now the president of Alaska Maritime.
Hmm.
And we got our start, personal start, at that time.
Interesting.
Yeah. So, like I said, when I first came in here, you meet a person, and this person leads you to another person, and then there's an outcome there, and this goes on, and this is the way Alaska, this is the way Alaska has gone.
Yeah.
It's a history from person to person. Before these phones.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm not against the phones. I've got one. I run my business from my phone.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can do that.
So, but let's go back to your dog team. You had a dog team that you used to deliver your meat with, both in the summer and the winter. Did you end up with more teams, or did you always just sort of have the one?
We always had a dog team.
Mm-hmm.
Now, mine was a professional dog team.
So did you go up into Bella area and any of those areas, or where did you...
No, my biggest runs would be down the... mostly, remember, coastal people stay on the coast.
Yeah.
Coastal people don't go into interior much.
Mm-hmm.
Because we don't know the country. Now, the furthest back I would go would be back Coosa Train and Salmon Lake. In fact, this is before Iditarod. I said, I got to get some country running in, I told my wife, you know. So I said, I think I'll go up to Coosa Train. We always fish Coosa Train in the fall for whitefish. We'd seen whitefish up there for our dogs.
Mm-hmm.
And so I said, I got to go up there. So I took the dog team and drove up there. And we lived on rabbits and whitefish for almost a month.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, I met somebody up there, and he says, I got a place. I had a place to stay. My brother-in-law's got had a cabin up there.
Mm-hmm.
I had a place to stay, and I just stayed up there and shot rabbits and and fished under the ice. It's just another one of those things. And we always had that dog team. We had a dog team probably from 68 up until probably in the late 90s.
Oh, really?
Yeah, we had dog team for quite a while. But then the tour started to go down, and another thing, too. What really hurt tourism in Alaska is that the phone came along, the internet.
So how did that hurt?
You can go to the internet and book a tour anywhere in the world.
Yes.
Without going through... You can go through the agency. You can do it on your own. There's booking service.
Mm-hmm.
There's all this. And what happened in the early days, it was mostly the tour business was basically run by companies. Mm. You work for the company on a commission. Okay. What happened when the internet came, a lot of guys found out that they didn't need the big companies. And the big companies found out they didn't need the people. You got an internet address, bingo.
Right.
You're in it. And that happened. And that made it really hard on certain types of tour businesses. And the one we had here just folded up.
What kind of tour business did you have?
Okay, they would, planes would come in from other places and land. And then we had a tour that we took them around town. We gave them a dog training demonstration. We panned gold, showed them. Nome has a great history. More history than Kotzebue or any other place, because this is where this is where the big thing started. People came here to buy gold. Gold was king, and it isn't anymore. But well, that's another story. It is, but it's a different story.
Okay, we'll come back to that.
We'll come back to that.
Yeah,
but gold was king in those days, and so what happened is that the tourists got further and further down, and they got in the hole. And one day they came to us and they said, well, we're just not going to be able to do this anymore. So I held on to the dogs for, you know, for a little while longer, hoping that things would come back. In fact, it got so bad that the president of the company, wife, she held some money out for us so we'd get paid. And it got that bad.
Aww.
Yeah, it was just bad management.
Yeah.
And they offered to sell it to me, and I said, no, not really. I really don't want to get into that business.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just wanted to work in it.
Right.
And it was good living, really. Yeah. I got paid by the head.
Yeah.
And that was nice, you know.
Right.
Just...
yeah. So come back to how gold was king, and now it's coming back.
What's happened now is that the same places that they found gold at the beginning of the century, there's still gold there. The big gold thing came when the guy went down to the beach. This is history. He went down to the beach. He had been fired or wasn't happy where he's working for another miner. Went down on the beach, put a sluice box in, and found gold.
Right.
Right in the beaches of Nome.
Yeah.
And they had a deal. There was no rules. This is when there was no government. There was nothing here. So what they had, a kind of a rule that you could extend your part of that beach as far as the number two shovel would reach on either side of it. So that was your, they had agreed on that. And they were finding out, my God, remember gold is only $35 an ounce or less. I'm not exactly sure what it was, but it isn't what it is today.
Yeah.
Today it's $1,500 an ounce, give or take. And so what happened is that that brought all the guys, the independent guys, down to the beaches, and that was another whole thing. Well, the gold comes down from the inland, and down through the centuries, there's these beach lines. They call them beach lines, and that's where the gold stops because it can't go any further. It's heavier.
Yeah.
It's heavier than water. That's why they use sluice boxes. And so anyway, the gold. So in 1962, the guys closed down the dredges. They couldn't make it anymore. The gold wasn't moving. And it stayed at 200. I think when they closed the big dredges, it was $2.50.
Jeez.
Yeah. And that was it. Now, the big dredges were after the fine gold because the dredge works good for fine gold. The nuggets, they tend to bounce off the back.
Oh.
Yes. That's another story, which I'll get to later. They tend to bounce off the back. They want the gold that there's the most of because the dredges, I've been on a dredge. Oh, my God. It's a complicated thing. These things, and they get it up, and then it goes through the processors down in below. And several of my sons work for them. You start out, like I said earlier, in the thaw fields. And so when it got to the point where they couldn't mine this gold and make it pay, they closed down the dredges, and there they sit to this day. Remember, these dredges were, most of them were not, they were manufactured in California, and they were brought up here by pieces. They were hauled out to these different places by horses, and they were put together, and tremendous expense. But remember, this is at early dollars.
Yeah.
Remember, from World War II, this way, we've had terrible inflation.
Mm-hmm.
Stuff that, well, look at gold. Okay, gold was $250. Now it's $1,500. Mm-hmm. So those things have changed. But now, in, I forget the year, but Shell Oil came up and drilled right by the causeway there, that whole area there. They found gold.
Mm-hmm.
And some guys were smart enough to buy those leases from Shell Oil later on.
Hmm.
And have made a funnel off of those leases because they've been peddled and peddled and they've been sectioned off and made into, and there's been a, see, we don't hear about the gold that, now if I catch fish,
mm-hmm.
there's somebody writing that down.
Right.
And I never let you forget it. But in gold, there's nobody writing it down.
They don't have to go somewhere and say how much they've...
No.
Oh.
No.
Huh. Interesting.
Yeah. So, okay, here in a perfect example. 2 years ago, I had a net out, and one of those stupid miners ran over it with his little rinky-dink dredge, and, of course, tore it all up, took off, and I found it. It happened to be my king salmon net, worth it. Okay, who am I going to go to?
Right.
I don't even know the guy. They don't have to register anywhere.
Hmm.
See?
It's not like a car accident where you can put a note on the windscreen or something like
No, half of these guys, well, another thing too, they're supposed to pay to keep those dredges at the port. But some of them don't keep them at the port. They take them home or they take them and park them out of the city limits or some other place. So there's nobody to police them. And it's all by leases. You lease. You lease. And there's guys that lease this stuff.
Hmm.
And probably you never know who it is.
Right.
And with fishermen, oh my God, we're there. The government, the state knows who I am.
Mm-hmm.
And the federal government knows who I am because I'm involved with them. I filled out their 10 pages of paperwork, you know, to do what I'm doing. And I called Juneau. Now, prior to that, they had somebody up here that had a boat, and they were trying to keep some law and order. And I told the lady that was in charge, I says, you got to get up here and get somebody in charge of this thing. Because I see it every day. These guys are mining in areas that don't belong to them because there's nobody to tell them not to.
Hmm.
And I said, "It's what's happening is that... And they just had another lease here recently.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, you got to do something about this. I said, they're running over fish nets and everything. And I says, and another thing too, when I call a fisherman's meeting, the fishermen come. They call a meeting, nobody shows up. Mm-hmm. Because they're all incognito. I call it incognito. They're just...
You don't even know who they are.
Yeah.
Huh.
So do you see that potentially changing in the future, like from your conversation?
Well, it'll be what's happening now is that some guys aren't going to make it.
Hmm.
I mean, that's the way gold mining is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, and fishing is the same way. 10% of the fishermen catch 90% of the fish.
Hmm.
Hmm.
The rest of them are just changing. We call it changing dollars.
Yeah. So you've got three boats out there.
I've got three boats.
Wow. So how many crew do you have then?
My two sons are captain.
Mm-hmm.
My captain's license was up this year, and I didn't renew it.
Well, you're 88.
I'd had to go through such a turmoil of
medicals.
Medical.
Right. Even though you're in great health.
I'm in great health. I still have to go. I went through the medical 5 years ago.
Right.
And finally, my doctor said, yeah, he's okay. And then, you know, he gave me the okay, but I knew him, and this is 5 years later.
Yeah.
So my two sons have captain's license. Our boats are all licensed and insured. We carry $1 million liability insurance on them. They're all insured. They're all paid for.
Wow. That's That's amazing. And then how much crew do you need to operate
these boats? My two sons operate the boats.
Uh-huh.
And I have a daughter that works for Alaska Airlines.
Okay. But she's
part of the crew.
Part of the crew.
Yeah, and I get to fly free.
Oh, very good. Very good. That's great. Yeah, wow. Yeah. So when do you start fishing? What's the season?
One thing nice about our company is that we start up when the ice is gone and we quit when the ice comes back.
So whatever that happens to be every year.
But the trouble is, it doesn't work that way. The ice went out early last year and everything commenced just at the regular time.
Oh.
Because nobody was told. How do you tell a shipping company who has made their plans, a five-year plan, that all of a sudden...
This year's different.
Yeah, no, you can't. So that was of no value to us.
It's not like you gained a month or two.
No, all we did was gain a little extra time to do our maintenance and to maybe do some subsistence fishing, mm-hmm. Before. That's one thing that we've done regularly ever since I got here. We've subsistence fishing.
Do you do subsistence hunting at all, too?
I used to.
You used to.
I don't anymore.
Right.
But my sons are into it.
Right.
And I have, we barter.
Yeah,
we barter. In fact, my wife gets muktuk
mm-hmm.
from Barrow.
Mm-hmm.
She has relatives in Barrow. And then we trade dry fish.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have a friend that catches a lot of cod, and I trade him cod. I trade him silver salmon for cod. And we do it just like people who've always done it, and I feel you can be successful in Nome if you do it like they always did.
Mm-hmm.
And
anybody hunting reindeer as much anymore?
No, they're kind of caribou.
Caribou, because you said the numbers were going down.
Well, what's happened is the caribou have absorbed. Absorbed.
Hmm.
And it's really strange. The last time my sons went out hunting, there was a caribou hunting. They got a couple caribou, they brought them home. Remember, I'm a butcher.
Yes.
I cut these two open. They had that much fat on their rumps, and there was no testicles.
Really?
And that told me that those two animals, and I estimated at their age, we can estimate their age by the splinter bones that run up the legs here.
Okay.
And
what, the larger the bones, the older the animal?
The small bone. There's a small bone in there, and when that's heavily calcified, you'll know that that's an older animal.
Okay.
And these two animals, both of them had been castrated. I estimated their age at probably 10 to 15 years.
Wow.
Yeah, because they have a long life. They're they've been fixed.
Yes.
So they were great eating. I aged them kind of late in the spring, and I managed to, we have a tin building where we age meat.
Mm-hmm.
I hung them up in the manger in our barn there, and man, they were delicious.
Mm.
Yeah, because they were steers.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right.
Now, normally in the old reindeer days, they only butchered steers.
Oh, they didn't do females at all.
No. And that was one of the downfalls, is that the younger guys that came in were too lazy sometimes to go out and get the castrated ones, or keep them where they had them at.
Easy.
Because they make the best meat.
Right.
I mean, we knew that.
Huh.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, you don't want to kill the females because the females produce one a year.
Right.
Yeah. So.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, there's all kinds of. I used to like history,
mm-hmm.
and now I found out I'm part of history. when you're around for for three quarters of a century.
Well, and all you've done.
And things you have to do,
There's
a thing called living. that drives you to a lot of things. And I've done a lot of different things. And
it's
been a great...
And now you go to the grocery store and the meat's all packaged somewhere else,
Another thing, too, I know what's happening. I go to each store here in town and I measure the meat counter, the fresh meat counter, about this much. Think about it, about this much. Mm. Yeah. Everybody, the madam housewife now is buying the majority of stuff preserved and frozen.
Right.
Yeah. And it's too bad, really. You know.
Change in the way we buy groceries and a change in the way food processing is.
Yeah, I've managed grocery stores off and on, too. And it's the same story. Yeah, they're running the same thing. Grocery stores aren't grocery stores anymore. Well, they eat my date.
Every time I
look at that, I just gotta.
Yeah.
You know, it don't mean a thing. It's in a tin can. Or it's froze solid. Right. You know, it's not gonna.
Yeah.
It's not gonna spoil. I put meat in my freezer every year. We vacuum pack everything. I was one of the first ones to get a vacuum packer. And man, we put stuff in the freezer and it lasts till we eat it.
Keeps really good.
I got three freezers full.
Do you really?
Yeah, we got a lot of bartering.
Very good. Very good.
But you got to eat good.
Yes.
That's the whole key if you're going to. And subsistence, really, it's starting to die.
Yeah. Do you guys do berry picking too?
We do everything.
Yeah.
Yeah, my daughters, like I say, I have 10 children. And my daughters come to Nome in the summertime and pick berries.
Mm.
We have berries by the gallon.
Imagine. Yeah.
And we got berry patches, too.
Do you?
Yeah.
Your own special place is where you go.
Yeah. Things become like that. You know, if you stay in a place long enough.
That's right.
Everything comes.
Yeah.
It's always there, you know.
Yeah.
How much you want to eat.
Yeah.
Yeah, we have silver salmon, chum salmon, pinks. We dry fish. We smoke fish, halibut.
Do you actually have a fish camp somewhere?
Farley's Fish Camp.
Farley's Fish Camp.
It's right down there at the, you know where it is, right down there at the, before it makes the turn. And it's the first unofficial Nome checkpoint. Farley's Camp.
For the
That's
Agata
where
run.
The radio stations, they go down in their spotter vehicle and they spot the as they come across the road. That means they're on their way into Nome, and then they follow them along, giving you the updates minute by minute. And when they get to the dredge, that's when the siren is run. Now, remember, in the old days when the Nome Kennel Club was running their races, the military, that's called Fort Davis down there, and the military was down there, and they shoot a cannon off. And I asked them one day, the Iditarod. I says, well, what do you want? Well, that siren upsets our dogs. You know, modern people are. And I said, okay, we'll go back to shooting the cannon off. How would you like that? Because I could get the National Guard to do that.
Right.
They'd love to do that. You know? They wouldn't even have to be told. They'd just ask them and they'd be tickled to death.
That would be really upsetting to
everybody. Oh, yeah. So we've been through that. And like I said, there's a story to everything. When we first decided to ring the siren, we had an old siren that used to be up on the old grade school, which was right up here. And it was up on top. And the fireman, the fire chief, he says, I'll get the damn thing going. He'd go up there. He had to go up there and kick it a couple of times, knock the ice off it, because they never used the siren in the wintertime. And they'd try it out, you know, and finally they got onto it and started doing it.
Right.
Now they push a button or down at headquarters.
And it goes off.
Yeah, and it goes off, and it goes off. And what that is, that means you got 20 minutes to get down to Front Street and watch the musher come in.
So just for the purposes of the recording, I'm just going to say that Howard and Joe Reddington were the two men responsible for starting the Iditarod.
A lot of other people.
And a lot of other people, too.
A lot of other people, too. And you know what Joe told me? He says, yeah, and by the way, I'll put you on the board of directors. He was the board of directors. He had some people in Anchorage that he had convinced the same thing. And as I went along the trail in last place a lot of times, alone, and I'd run into a place, and the guy said, Joe told me that he could charter my airplane or my boat or, you know, my snowmobile, and you owe me money. I says, okay, I'll take your IOUs, and when I get back, I'll turn it over to the finance committee. That was Joe. And for years, it took a long time to pay this off.
Yeah.
But what we did is Muktuk Marston.
Yes, Muktuk
Marston was one of our He gave $10,000 to the first Iditarod.
Wow.
In fact, he came to town and he tore his pants. So my wife took him up to the house. Take your pants off.
Sew them up.
She sewed his pants.
So the very first Iditarod race was
1973.
Right.
And it's run continuously.
Yeah.
And in the bylaws, the race shall start the first Saturday of March.
Mm-hmm.
It shall not be canceled or postponed.
So that's why it's always started on that day.
That's right.
Whether there's snow or not, they figured out where to go.
That's right.
Because a couple of years ago, it had to start from Fairbanks.
Which is fine.
It just went, we went down and watched
it.
That's
an alternate.
It's an alternate.
That year that they started from Fairbanks, my wife and I we were the mushers.
Oh, then I probably saw you.
Yeah. I was standing out in the thing there.
So they do the ceremonial start usually in Anchorage on the main street, and then they start actually in Willow.
Yeah.
And has that always been the...
No. The first race, we went from Tudor Track.
Oh.
That's the sprint racing track in Anchorage.
Mm-hmm.
We went from there all the way to Nome.
Wow.
And up Cook Inlet.
Oh, wow.
With 30-foot tides.
Jeez.
If it had gone wrong, it would have drowned the whole works.
Oh, my goodness.
It was incredible.
Yeah.
I had the longest dog team in the longest sled in the race.
You had the lengthwise?
Lengthwise, yeah. I had a 13-foot sled.
Wow.
In the first, that wasn't my longest one.
And
I had a 16-footer at home.
And how many dogs did you have?
I went with 15.
Uh-huh.
Most guys would go with 16. We had a guy show up with 20, 25.
Is there a rule on how many you
yes,
can
that's
have?
Yes, there's a rule.
I was going to say, you can't have 50 dogs.
Let me tell you that story. a musher who just died a few weeks ago.
And who was that?
I won't mention his
name. Because of the story.
Yeah, that's part of the story. He showed up with a 20-foot sled and 25 dogs and a cage on his sled. And I was there at the start. The race marshal was there. We both, as he came down the line, I looked at the race marshal. He looked back at me, and he went over to the guy. He was wearing a military hat with flaps. He picked one flat up, and he says, "Get rid of the cage." So at the next checkpoint, he got rid of the.
What was the purpose of the cage?
He was going to run 20 dogs at a time and rest 5 in the cage.
Oh my heavens!
Then the next year, a lot of the guys cooked their dog food out there. Uh-huh. You know, they would cook the meat and whatever, you know. The next year he showed up with a stove on his sled. A regular little stove. Now, they have stoves now, but they're smaller.
Yes.
You know? They're propane. But he had a stove and you have to put wood in and smoke it.
Jeez.
And that... Then I'll give you the final.
Mm-hmm.
1 year at the race, a guy shows up with a hood over his head. And he talked Russian. And he said that as soon as he finished the race in Nome, he was going to go back to Russia by dog team.
Hmm.
There's still people on the Yukon River that believe that. I'll let it stand there.
Oh, my heavens, that's funny. So every year you still go down, wish them all to come in, wish them...
Well, sometimes we go down. Finally, they got a nice banquet down there, too.
Yeah.
And that's where the mushers draw their position out of a muckluck.
Down in Anchorage, yeah.
Yeah, and that's a big deal.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's a huge thing. And I go down once in a while.
Mm-hmm. And then here in Nome,
I'll be at the banquet. But let me tell you the story of the banquet. Last March, I went to the banquet. I had a presentation to make. And I made the presentation. I came down off the stage, walked back, sat down in my chair, and I almost passed out.
Oh.
My wife looked over at me and she says, "We got to go to ER." And I was sitting at the table with the race's veterinarian.
There's your ER. So,
the veterinarian helps me to the car. My wife takes me to ER, and that was the beginning of me getting a heart valve.
Oh.
Because I was having trouble breathing, mm-hmm. and everything was slow. And so anyway, I kind of laughed because just one table over was a whole table full of doctors. Stu is his name, and last year I got him aside and I kidded him about that. I just, there I was, I'm not having a heart attack, but I'm having a real tough time, and who takes me
to the hospital? The doctors. Very funny.
The dog doctor.
Gosh.
he got a big charge.
Well, Howard, is there anything else you'd like to talk to?
I could talk for hours. Remember, I'm a storyteller.
I know, and you're a wonderful storyteller.
This is what I do at the museum.
Yeah.
I'll be up there. I usually up there for 5 days.
Are you?
And I just pick up anybody happens to wander in. And
you just sit dozing and talks to people. Yeah, that's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's been a delight.
I enjoy it. And, you know, people have been, they always want a storyteller to write books and everything. Nah.
It's different.
It is different.
You
got to have all those quotes and got to tell the truth all the time. And that's no fun. That's no fun at all.
So now that the cruise ships are coming in, do you do some of the tourism with all of them now?
All we're doing, I'm the meter and greeter.
Okay. That's great.
Yeah, we have crew members come in from all over the world. Mm-hmm. A lot of them are Filipino. They're from India, from Russia. There's foreign crews are all mixed crews.
Yeah.
American crews, of course, they don't have to, we don't have many American cruise ships. In fact, there's hardly any.
Mm.
They're just on the inland waters.
Oh.
But most cruise ships, this next year, we're going to have 15 stops.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. Katie's got them on her calendar there. It's amazing.
Yeah. And this is what's happening is that they'll change crews. They'll change passengers.
Oh.
And Nome. They'll fly a whole bunch in and then fly a whole bunch out.
Right.
And that works great because if they're anchored out, then we get some of that work.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone that anchors or comes to the dock, we have to provide the pilot for them.
I see. Interesting. Yeah. So you're the pilot boats back
and
forth.
We're the pilot boat, yeah. And last year, we had the World come.
Yeah.
It's a huge ship.
Really?
And it travels all over the world. Mm-hmm. The people that ride in it own it.
Wow.
You buy a share in it.
Oh, my heavens.
And you travel all over the world.
Wow.
Yeah. They go everywhere. It's just amazing.
That is amazing.
Wow. That's the second trip we've had with them.
Is it changing the town at all with the cruise ships coming in like
We're trying to get them, but, you know, this town has really changed.
How?
People are moving to the outside.
Hmm.
They're not in...
You mean they're moving to the outskirts of town and not living down
in
the...
Not living in the core.
Okay.
And remember I was telling you about the core.
Yes.
The core is where people are close together. People know each other.
Right.
When people would come into my meat market, I knew everybody.
Mm-hmm.
I knew their names. I knew how thick they wanted their salami sliced.
Yeah.
And now everything is there's no personal thing like that. And it was really funny. It was February, one of the years I was working over there. It was cold. It was miserably cold. We haven't had any real cold weather for a couple of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it was cold. And the little lady comes walking in there. And I says, we deliver, you know. She says, I just want to see how bad it was. She walked all the way down. Mm-hmm. And everybody had an account.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had an account. There was cash, but most everybody had an account. They called in on the telephone.
Yep.
When they got the telephone, ordered their groceries, and then the truck would deliver it to their
and
house.
They come in and pay their account off.
Pay their accounts off mm-hmm. once a month.
Yeah.
And it was all, this is before credit cards.
Right, yeah.
And I'm happy that I was able to live during those times.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Because they are really different from now.
Yeah.
My gosh. And another thing, too, when the Iditarod Notion got started, Joe and I set up a time, and he says, if you're going to call me at midnight. And I says, well, what's it? He had 500 dogs.
Wow.
You know why he had 500 dogs?
No.
He had a contract with the U.S. government, the Air Force, to haul out all the military planes that had crashed in Alaska.
Really?
So he had set up a kind of a small company, and he had this huge number of dogs, and they would go into these remote places and take these airplanes apart and bring them back. Because remember, at that time in our history, we were starting to fly.
Mm-hmm.
We were starting to fly over the pole. We were starting to fly other than amphibious to all parts of the world. The DC-6 had been invented, and the bigger ship planes were coming. And this changed the whole aviation lookout. People would be flying over. Remember, those planes only flew at 10,000 feet. A lot of people don't realize that. It was rough, too. Oh, my gosh, you know. Now if you fly 30 or 40,000 people, and it's flat.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, he had to go up, and a lot of these, we had lend-lease with Russians.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a building out here. There's an old hangar out here, and it's left over from that era.
Isn't it? Oh.
They would fly the planes here. The Russians would pick them up here and fly them over to Siberia.
Hmm.
And the problem is, we gave the Russians, the ones we really didn't like, they gave them the Aerocobra, Bell Aerocobra, which was the coffin.
Yeah.
And so they were crashed all over. And a lot of them had, some were bombers, had those gun sites, those sites for bombing,
yep,
which was considered very, very secretive.
Yes.
And a lot of them had live ammunition. And so, and if people be flying over at 10,000 feet on a calm day, you can look out there and see a plane that's crashed.
Right.
Hmm.
And so his job was to go out there and bring all this junk in.
And then where were they going to, they were going to pool it somewhere and then take it out?
It would be taken to the military.
Right.
Because after the war, the military destroyed a tremendous amount of equipment.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, they just threw it in the ocean. Yeah, I was out at At 2. Yeah,
yes,
I've been
you were
at 2? I was at 2. And at 2, when we came in with a small boat, the dock was 6x6 tractor, these big flatbed trucks.
Really?
That's their dock. We came in and tied alongside of that. And then we were out at a lot of the bases out there, at ADAC and all these other bases. And they had orders to destroy all kinds of stuff.
Wow.
Because when the war was over, it was over. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was declared over. And we went into Quonset huts out there in the Aleutians, where the guys got right up from the table and jumped on a barge and got out of there because the war was over.
Wow.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah. Wow. It was tremendous, the amount of stuff that, the amount of stuff that
and was... And on Attu, there was so much ammunition that was still left that hadn't exploded.
Yeah, it was a dangerous place.
Yeah, yeah. Very dangerous.
They had a Coast Guard...
yes, they did.
I was on the Sweetbriar. Sweetbriar was the ship that hauled all of the... Loran equipment into each one of the Loran stations.
Oh, really?
Yes. We built the Loran stations.
One
of the big contractors, I can't think of the name, one of the big contractors built all of the Loran stations. There was one at Attu, there was one here, there was one in down by Sitka.
One here in Nome?
Yeah. Not in Nome, but out at Port Clarence.
Okay.
And they built all of those, and then our job was to bring the ETs, the technicians in, and the equipment to set up the Loran stations.
Mm, wow.
Yeah. And the Loran stations were all shut down.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And that was, I've still got mixed feelings about that, being a mariner.
Mm.
Because at that same time we were closing down, the Chinese shot a satellite out of the air. And that could very well happen to our navigation system too.
Mm, right.
With no backup.
Yeah.
No on-the-ground backup, so.
Hmm.
The Aleutians was a mess. Yeah. I was in Dutch Harbor.
Wow.
Yeah. I was in Dutch Harbor in 52.
Mm-hmm.
And the war...
Not long after the war.
Not after the war. Was just barely over.
Yeah.
And we could still see the see all the military.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah.
Gosh.
I hit most of the Aleutians. Hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So Joe needed 500 dogs.
Yes, to just take care of that problem. And Joe came to Alaska in 1949,
mm-hmm.
and they were offering homesteads at that time. He got a homestead, and he kept the dogs out in the woods and changed the trees. And each one had a number 10 can.
Really?
Food can.
Yeah.
Nailed to the tree. And so Joe had to go out there and feed 500 dogs.
No wonder it was midnight.
Because he's in town all day doing other stuff.
Yeah.
And so anyway, I said, okay, I'll try and call you at midnight. So I'm calling him at midnight. And pretty soon, Pete gives me a call, and he says, Howard, your phone bill is $750.
Because everything was long distance.
Everything was long distance to Anchorage in those days.
Right.
He says, mine's $1,500. We'd been calling each other back and forth on this Iditarod thing. And that's when I finally, and it took a lot of encouragement for them. Not go. The heart was to go to Iditarod.
Mm-hmm. You said go to Iditarod and back to Anchorage.
And I told him, I said, the time you get back to Anchorage, it's going to be spring. There's nobody interested in the dogs. And then, and I said, another thing, I looked up at Iditarod. There's nothing there.
Mm-mm.
Just a bunch of old buildings. The gold mining there petered out in 1913.
Yeah.
They got all the gold and they moved out. And so, well, I don't know. And he's dealing with something that he doesn't know, and I'm dealing with something I don't know. You know.
Wow. So finally you got it to Anchorage to Nome.
Oh, to Nome.
Yeah.
Well, I told another thing, too. Nome has the history of dog mushing.
Mm-hmm.
Remember the serum run in 1925. His house is right across the street from mine.
Mm.
It was.
Was it?
Yeah.
Oh, my.
It burned down a long time ago. That's that house that burned.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. I live in a National Historical house.
Which house do you live
in? It's the Berger House.
Okay.
Carrie, I'll think about it in a minute. Mm-hmm. I've been living there for 50 years. She wrote books.
Okay.
Yeah. Carricker. Sally Carricker.
Okay.
It's the Sally Carricker house.
Oh.
And she came to Alaska as a reporter for the Saturday Evening Post. She wrote articles for them. She was also in this area for scientific matters. They were investigating the mice.
Mice?
Yes. Think about it. The mice that go over the cliff.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're not called mice, but you know what I'm talking about.
No, I don't. I thought you were talking about actual mice.
They are a mouse.
What kind of mouse?
Maybe like a lemming?
Lemmings.
Lemmings. Oh, yeah. Lemmings.
The lemmings had a history of going over cliffs,
yeah.
And everybody would follow.
Yes.
She was up here to investigate lemmings.
Hmm. Well, I'll be.
Now, another thing, Farley Moad.
I know.
Okay.
Yep.
Farley Moad had a movie, and also had a book
mm-hmm.
about the little lemmings.
Hmm.
Yeah, think
okay,
about
I'll
it.
Have to look that one.
Look it up.
I don't
look
remember
it up.
That one. Yeah.
Yep. Yep.
Okay.
And here's the lemming story. When Mrs. Wolf gets pregnant, she cannot run with the pack if the pack is tracking caribou. Because
mm-hmm.
the pack has to travel with the caribou. That's the way it's done. So she has a den, has her babies, and her male will generally stay with her. And what do they feed them?
Lemmings.
Lemmings, because that's the most prevalent meat source.
Yes.
And that's what it's all about.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody says, oh, yeah, it's all about caribou. No, no, no. It's about a little mouse.
Mm.
And it's really strange. I go out to the camp, and I go out to the camp every day. We were out there just a couple hours ago. And there's always a couple old ravens sitting on the telephone wires, and you know what they're looking for. That old smart raven will sit up there and he'll watch the snow, because mm-hmm. these lemmings stay active all winter long under the snow, and once in a while they'll pop their head up and raven's going to get them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what why ravens are still here. That's why they're here. They've learned to live off of us, but they've also learned how to live off the land. And I've been out dog mushing a lot of times, absolutely alone. I wouldn't let my son go out alone another day on a snow machine. I used to go out on a dog team alone.
Yeah.
And but I've seen ravens out there, and you know what they're doing.
Right.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Very historic. Yeah. Howard, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for all your stories.
Thank you.
Love your stories. Yeah. Thank you so much.
And you'll be giving presentations during Iditarod as well?
Yeah. Okay. I'll be up at the museum every day.
Okay.
And I'll just take people as they come. One time I was sitting there. I'm going to make a deal with the tour company this year to deliver them to me. And poor Richard, you know our mayor is...
Yes.
Mayor's just had a heart attack.
Oh, I did not know that.
Yes, he had a stroke.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
Yeah, he's a tour guy.
Yes.
You got to take a tour with him. You just got to do it.
Okay.
He is a jewel.
Yes.
And him and I, we've been friends for a long, long time. And he's got some real nice insights into tourism.
Mm-hmm.
He's hooked on it too.
Yeah, he's quite a character. Well, I'm going to turn this off now and say thank you very much.
Oh, you
thank
bet.
You, Katie.
Thank you.